Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
It is a great pleasure to welcome to the program N.T. Wright, who might have been called just a few years ago the writing bishop, playing on both write and write. But you have some, but you're no longer a bishop. You decided to leave your bishopric at Durham in the U.K.
Yeah.
In the northeast of England to get back to full-time writing, I guess.
More or less, yes. I'm still a bishop. Once a bishop, always a bishop, like being once a priest, always a priest. By the way, let me say what a pleasure it is to be back with you again.
Well,
thank you very much.
But
I had some stuff which I have to do, which is some major research and writing on the Apostle Paul, particularly the big book that I've been wanting to write for years. And I realized that if I stayed in Durham much longer, either it wouldn't get written or I'd have to start from scratch again in maybe when I was 70 or something. So I decided to accept an invitation I'd had to the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, which is a wonderful place to be.
Poking around on the internet looking for some material relating to you as I was preparing today, I ran across the full list of your published books. And it turns out to be over 40, or is it 50?
It's somewhere between 50 and 60, I think.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, it's a curious thing. I see them all sitting there on publishers' tables and things. They've all got my name on. It's very odd. I must have had something to do with them, but it feels as though it's actually somebody else that's done it.
They're touched, disembodied, or dissociated, are they?
Yes, it's very strange.
We come to the very basic question that you've addressed in this book. The new book is titled Simply Jesus, A New Vision of Who He Was, What He Did, and Why He Matters. You're taking up very basic stuff. And who he was is, of course, a question that has agitated all sorts of people for the last century or more. The modern interest in the historical Jesus, I suppose, really is kicked off by Albert Schweitzer.
Well, it goes back a long way behind Schweitzer.
It goes way back to Reimarus.
To Reimarus at the end of the 18th century, although he didn't publish his work himself. It was considered too controversial. But that was really part of the Enlightenment project, that in the Enlightenment, as you know, there was a sense that God has been kicked upstairs and we're now going to organize history downstairs in our own way. And part of that is, what are we going to say about Jesus? So you either say he was a Jewish revolutionary who failed in the revolution, or he was a wild apocalyptic prophet who said the world was going to end, and then that didn't happen either. And so what are you left with? And so a lot of work in the 19th century, mainly in Germany, was done around that. Schweitzer pulled it all together, gave it a new lease of life. The English-speaking world took a long time to catch up with that. It was really only in the 20th century that happened.
Schweitzer also gave us a great phrase. His book title in German is Der Besuch dem historischen Jesu, Search for the historical Jesus.
Yeah. And, of course, the word historical means a lot of different things to different people, because for some people, historical means we are going as post-Enlightenment rationalists to say what we will allow to be historical and not, and then you basically decide the question ahead of time, and then Jesus is just a good guy who had some nice ideas and some wacky ones, but to be discounted in terms of theology.
Who was that British rabbi who some 20 years ago did a book titled The Passover Plot?
Oh, Hugh Schoenfeld.
Schoenfeld.
Yeah.
And he deals with the apocalyptic, the revolutionary Jesus. Right,
that was a bizarre book, though. I mean, it was more like 40 years ago, I think. I read it when I was in my late teens, so it can't have been.
Well,
that
I guess
recent.
He did another version of it.
Oh, maybe.
I did a program with him on it about 20 years ago.
Right. I, to be honest, I don't think any, dare I say, serious scholars take that book seriously. I mean, there's so many other Jewish writers who have written about Jesus from a variety of angles. I mean, one of the great gains of the last generation is that we all now are signed up to the fact that Jesus was a Jew, a first century Jew. That used to be a rather controversial, dangerous thing to say. Now we all know that. But the question is, what sort of Jew was he? And of course, first century Judaism is pluriform. It's got a lot of different things going on. Does Jesus fit into some of it and not others? He's got to be comprehensible, but he's also got to be, so to speak, crucifiable. And that's the real historical challenge.
A good old friend of mine, who used to be on this program rather often until he left town, he still pops in on occasion, is John Dominic Crossan, whom I know you know quite well. And, of course, Dominic is a leading interpreter of the historical Jesus, and though he does it in a rather wispy and terribly charming Irish way, basically what he's saying is he was just a man, but a very fine man.
Yes. He does. And Dom and I are actually, I think, are going to be doing a program about Jesus in a week or two in San Francisco. So we'll have I'll have the discussion one more time with him. We go around those tracks. Part of the difficulty is that our culture has not been clever at talking about God. And there's a residual Epicureanism about modern culture, which is that if there is a God, he or she or it or they are a long way away and we don't do too much about them. And then it's difficult to see how you can fit that together with Jesus. What I've tried in this book and elsewhere to do is to explore more the variety of first century Jewish beliefs about God, which is that God ought to be, we're not sure if he is, but he ought to be actually around. He ought to be living in the temple. He ought to be breathing in the life of the world. He ought to be speaking to his people through the law and so on. And the question is, what would it mean for a first century Jew who believed that sort of stuff to think of somebody like Jesus being in some way an embodiment of this God? And it actually makes a lot of sense. But you have to understand what they believed about the temple, particularly because a lot of Jesus' imagery about what's going on is very much temple language, and particularly the idea that one day soon God was going to come back in person and sort the thing out. And when you see Jesus coming to Jerusalem, telling stories about a king who comes back to explain what he's doing coming to Jerusalem, then you have to say that either Jesus or somebody who made that up is actually lining up Jesus with the God of Israel.
Everything you have to say is very sophisticated and draws upon tremendous and perfected knowledge of Scripture and of all other related materials. I want to put a few very naive questions to you, because I think because I'm naive about these matters, and because I think they're in the minds of our listeners. So the first one is quite simply this: was obviously you think that Jesus is the Son of God and much more. Was he always, or was he born a man, and did he become? Was his identity a further development, evolution, creation, only on the base of his being a man?
No. And the phrase Son of God has several different meanings. In the Scriptures themselves, Son of God is a phrase for the King, the Messiah, and that was applied to Jesus, I think, during his own lifetime.
But Jesus was always the intended Christ.
Yes, the word Christ itself means Messiah, the one who sums up Israel's destiny in himself. And it seems to me that the early church quickly said that was who Jesus always had been. And the key thing then is that the resurrection for them demonstrated that was true. It was controversial before. Jesus was crucified with the words King of the Jews above his head. And as far as many people were concerned, that was the end of it. But then it's on the basis of the resurrection that they say, hey, wait a minute, this means that he actually really was that, and much more besides.
So he was on assignment for the Father from the very beginning.
Yes, indeed.
That is your view.
Yes, absolutely. And part of the difficulty, though, is what does it mean, on assignment? And we have, because of the nature of our culture, the way we talk about God, it's really rather difficult to nail that one down.
But that's, of course, exactly what I want to get to. Yep. What was the assignment? There was an American detective drama of some kind in which a crucial line was, your assignment, if you accept it, is that something was conveyed I forget who, but it's some daring do group of crime stoppers and so on. But what was his assignment? He did choose to accept it, but we need to know just what his assignment was, and we'll come to all of that directly we proceed after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return directly to N.T. Wright, drawing from a very compelling new book by him. Almost Thou Dost Persuade Me, but not yet, in that I am, after all, Jewish, not Christian. And there is a difference. But Jesus is a fascinating figure, eternally. He's generally viewed as the most significant person in the history of the world, or in the Western world, at least.
Well, I think that's probably right. Of course, you can line him up with all sorts of figures, but, I mean, Socrates would be an obvious example, or Mahatma Gandhi in our own last century. But yes, Jesus remains a haunting presence throughout Western culture. And that's an interesting... I reviewed a bunch of books recently, including the Pope's new book on Jesus and some others. And there's a sense that Western culture tries to shake him off and he keeps coming back again. And but in answer to your question before and your comment just now, of course, the assignment which Jesus had, I think he believed, was to bring to a head God's purpose for Israel, God's purpose for the Jewish people. people. It wasn't that he was starting a new religion over against Judaism. He really believed, like some other people in the first century did, that this was how the centuries-old purpose of God for Israel was going to be completed.
I must offer you a quotation. Can you guess who this is? I'll make a game out of it. I know men, and I tell you that Jesus Christ is no mere man. Between him and every other person in the world, there is no possible term of comparison. Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and I have founded empires. But on what did we rest the creation of our genius? Upon force. Jesus Christ founded his empire upon love, and at this hour millions of men would die for him.
I have heard that, and I have no idea who it was. Was it Napoleon or somebody?
It is Napoleon.
Yeah, okay. Phew. Sometimes we land on our feet, sometimes we don't.
Well, I wonder if that was, because he knew how to play a crowd as well. I wonder if deeply meant and deeply felt, or whether...
But the very interesting point that he makes is something that comes out in John's Gospel, when Pontius Pilate asks Jesus, are you a king? And Jesus says, well, I'm not your sort of a king, because if I was your sort of a king, my followers would fight to stop me being handed over. In other words, exactly as Napoleon said, he has a kingdom which isn't based on violence. And that's why people don't understand it. They say, if God is becoming king in and through Jesus, he ought to send in the tanks and sort the mess out. And that's precisely what Jesus doesn't do.
Let's come directly to the question that I was pressing a bit earlier, though I coined the notion of examining what his assignment was. Hmm. He had a mission.
Yeah.
And it must have been purposive from the very beginning. Yeah. What was it?
His mission, his slogan for his mission was the kingdom of God, which means this is the time for God to sort out the mess, to become sovereign over the world. And, of course, then the question is, what will that look like? How will we know? And Jesus went about doing stuff which he said was what it would look like if God did become king. So his feasting with all the sinners and outcasts and so on, his healings of people, these were the signs that God was taking charge.
The phrase you use in the book is that he was telling those around him, God will put the world right one day.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you say through human beings.
Through human beings, but starting, he was launching that project, but precisely because God wants to work through human beings and not around the back of them, as it were, that has to be through Jesus in the first instance, and then through others who follow Jesus and who have his spirit, through whose power they can actually get on with that job.
A wondering child's sort of question. Why does the world have to be put right? If God is the great creator and God is omniscient and God is all-loving, why didn't he make it right from the very beginning?
I think he did make it right from the very beginning, but I think precisely because God wanted to work through human beings have to have the capacity actually to be human and not to be puppets. And tragically, as in the great old Jewish stories in the book of Genesis, human beings say, actually, no, we want to do it our own way, thank you. And that's, in the Latin phrase, hinc illae lachrymae, that's where all the tears come from. I mean, that is the Jewish account, the ancient biblical account.
Yes, but if God is, again, all-powerful, all-seeing, all-arranging,
why
didn't he arrange for human nature to be different?
But those are Greek ideas, the idea of God being all this, all that, all the mm-hmm. other. One of the fascinating things to me about the ancient Jewish, ancient Israelite belief in God is that God is really rather disturbingly involved in the process. And God, having created a process called creation and then continuous creation, wants to be involved in that rather than just to be outside and be omniscient and all-powerful. Powerful and so on. So we've got a much more vivid, lively picture of God, but also a much more, dare I say, vulnerable one. And it's that God that then when you read the Gospels, you say, my goodness, supposing Jesus was the embodiment of that God, what would that mean?
Is it, who is it who says, I think it may be Augustine, who is asked, what was God doing before creation? And he says he's making hell for people who ask questions
For
like
people
that.
Who ask stupid questions.
But Luther repeats that as well.
I think it was Augustine, and Luther was an Augustinian monk. Yeah. So, yeah, he probably did. Yes.
But what ultimately, what's the metaphysics with which you work? Before, where did God come from? Is another way to ask the question in a kid's accent. Where did God come from?
God didn't come from anywhere. God was. I mean, one, as you know, the great ancient Hebrew name for God, which was unpronounceable, is to be translated as something like I am who I am, or I will be who I will be, a God full of potential and possibility. But as soon as you line up God in terms of some other scheme, he isn't God anymore. So if there is some sort of larger entity out of which he evolves, then he isn't isn't, at least he isn't the God that ancient Israel worshipped. That God is always, has always been, and will always be, and he's always sovereign over the rest of the process.
That remains, then, a mystery beyond our comprehension.
Necessarily. I mean, if we could comprehend it, it wouldn't be God. It's rather like, you know, that lovely line of C.S. Lewis when he said, "Daddy, I have a prejudice against the French," and his father said, "Why?" And he said, "If I knew that, it wouldn't be a prejudice." In the same way, you know, where did God come from? Well, if we knew that, he wouldn't be God.
Yeah. Back to Jesus.
Mm.
So his mission then was to somehow cure the world of its imperfections.
Well, to draw out the sting of all the evil which is residing in the world, and to allow it to do its worst to him, so that then a new form of creation could be launched. And that's the point of Jesus' resurrection. It isn't just about God doing fancy tricks on behalf of his special favorite or his son. It's about launching the whole project of a new world in which all sorts of different things will happen. Healing will happen, new possibilities.
What, as far as modern scholarship reveals it, and as far as you've come to some decision on this by close, very close examination of the scriptural material, what was his expectation as to what would happen through his mission, and when?
Well, I believe that Jesus knew he himself was going to have to die as part of this, and that's rooted in, again, the Jewish culture, which believed that somehow God would work through the death of the martyrs and all of that sort of thing. But at the same time, I think Jesus was happy just to launch this project. He says at one point to his followers that the final day, nobody knows, not even the Son, but only the Father, and we can be sure that the church didn't make that one up. And so Jesus is quite happy to say, "I'm starting this thing off. It's up to my Father as and when and how it comes about." And at one point, Jesus' followers say to him, aren't you going to restore the kingdom to Israel at this point? This is after he's been raised from the dead. And he said, "That's not the point. We're not talking about times and chronological calculations anymore. The time for that is past."
But does this have to be put in the political historical context? We've not yet even mentioned the Roman domination.
Absolutely.
But that's crucial in the whole
absolutely.
In the story, isn't it?
And as you know, in the book, I use this image of the perfect storm, where you have this great wind sweeping in from the west, which is the Roman imperial power. You have the high pressure system, the kind of overcooked, overheated expectation of the Jewish people. And Jesus slices in like a tropical storm from a different angle altogether, as prophets always did, saying, okay, God is going to act, but it won't look like you thought it would. And that sense of surprise, which is itself, I think, a deeply Jewish idea of a God of surprises who wants his people to respond to him, but has always got new stuff to say to them.
Samuel Sandmill, as I know, you probably knew Sam, didn't you?
I didn't know.
One of the great Jewish scholars of the New Testament.
Yeah.
In his book about Messianism in the time of Jesus in the Holy Land, tells us that there were many who essentially were on the same, who seemed to be on the same mission. Jesus had a model that he was following.
Jesus may have had various models. I think the model that a lot of people had in their minds was the model of Judas Maccabeus from almost exactly 200 years before the time of Jesus' public career. Then it was the Syrian pagan king who came and desecrated the temple and so on. And they had this little movement, and they marched into Jerusalem waving palm branches, and they cleansed the temple. And that made Judas's family, the royal dynasty, even though they weren't from the royal house of Judah, for the next 100 years. And so there were kind of patterns and possibilities there. But Jesus, I think, was going back to older models from Scripture itself, from Isaiah, from the Psalms, from 2 Samuel, you know, the stories of David and so on. Jesus was drawing out of that and the book of Zechariah, some of these places which are quite difficult for us to grasp, but it looks as though he had a vocation formed by his own meditation on the ancient Scriptures.
He's quite tough on some of his disciples.
Yes,
he speaks
absolutely
to them sometimes in a rather an abrupt and dismissive way.
Yeah, I think so.
He's even rather hard on his mother at some point.
Yes. I think Jesus has this knack, and you see it particularly in John's Gospel, of slicing through the kind of verbiage which is going on and putting his finger on the point. And sometimes it's almost like a non sequitur. So in John's Gospel, woman, what have you to do with me? My hour has not yet come. And I think
that's to his mother.
Yeah, to his mother. And I think it's almost like saying, mother, this is not the moment for that. Thank you very much. Nevertheless, you'll go and do it anyway. And my sense is that that actually this nests quite well within the rather robust Jewish way of talking to one another, but also talking to God. That one of the things I love about Jewish prayer is that often it's much more vivid and much more sort of looking God in the face and saying, now look, what's going on? And if you can talk like that to God, then you perhaps need to talk like it to other people as well.
3 or 4 years at the most of ministry around Galilee, and he's gone. Mm. He is crucified. We are about to pause for an update on the news. When we come back, we should really examine that great and riveting drama of his crucifixion, and of the meaning of his death for the rest of mankind. That is the notion of redemption and justification through the death of the Savior. That's a specially Christian idea. It's one which seems to me a touch alien but fascinating. Jesus died for me and to cleanse me of my sins. I wish I didn't feel as sinful as I do. But I think, like most human beings, I'm quite aware of my imperfections and some of the meanness in me that has probably hurt some other people over a rather long life. In fact, I have trouble as a secularist, and to be even more particularly a Jewish secularist, I have trouble understanding the whole notion of that redemption for ordinary people. If there's a gift that was offered to me through the death of Jesus, I don't understand the full nature of the gift or the wrapping in which one finds it. Well, let's come to that, if we may, and then, of course, to the fact of the crucifixion. As we return to conversation with N.T. Wright, drawing from his very, very challenging and superbly written, beautifully wrought new book, Simply Jesus, A New Vision of Who He Was, What He Did, and Why He Matters. And we return directly to that conversation after an update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
Our guest tonight is N.T. Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, get that spelling right, the author of Simply Jesus, and that's about your 55th or 60th book.
Something like that. I've stopped counting, yeah.
And it is published by Harper One. Before we say anything else, I know that you were at some church appointment earlier today.
Yeah, in Willow Creek.
At Willow Creek. Yeah. And you're going to be at the Fourth Presbyterian Church tomorrow, right here on Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, at 7 o'clock, Fourth Presbyterian, 126 East Chestnut Street. Mm-hmm. And I'll be talking about Simply Jesus, yes. About the book, about Jesus.
So let me come directly back to what I was asking before. What is the doctrine of justification? What does it have to do with the crucifixion of Jesus?
The nice little easy questions first. Huh? Justification basically means...
And what's wrong with John Piper's idea?
Now, come on, that's
you and
that's
he have
an
had an argument in print.
Well, we have in print. I've never met him, sadly. If he's listening to this program, hi, John, I wish we could get together sometime. But the way I would say it is this. God intends to put the world right. Part of the way in which he's doing that is by putting human beings right as a kind of pilot project and as part of the process by which he intends to put the world right. But the way he puts human beings right is through the death and resurrection of Jesus. And that's the bit which, as you were asking before that news break, which is very dense and dark. And frankly, I've been studying this stuff all my life. And each time I come to it, it's like this little knot of condensed puzzles and problems and biblical texts and so on. But at the heart of it, it's about the love of God. God is the creator who loved the world so much that he came in person to sort the mess out by drawing all the forces of hostility and accusation and negativity and evil onto himself, letting them do their worst to exhaust their power. And that's one way of saying it. There are other ways, but that means that everything that in which we participate that is evil and is negative, that Jesus died under the weight of that. We can, of course, grab it back for ourselves if we want to go on living that way, but what's happened is Jesus has broken through and made the possibility of new creation now into a reality.
So if you are born again to Jesus, what happens?
the language of being born again is something that John's Gospel has very clearly. Paul,
and the figure is more in American evangelicalism, I'm sure, than in British.
Yeah. I mean, in evangelicalism in general, the idea of being born again is quite important. But yes, it's been a major cultural feature in America in a way which British Christianity doesn't so much talk about it. But the idea is, I remember my godfather when I was young just putting it in a sermon once and said, something can actually happen to you in the course of your life where God can actually lay hold of you, and whether you say his spirit comes into you or whatever, but it's like being born in that when a baby is born, there are signs of life. The baby breathes, the baby cries. For the Christian, the breathing is believing and the crying is repenting. And these are the signs when you realize that something's happening in someone's life. And as a pastor, I've been privileged to see people's lives being radically transformed, sometimes quite quickly, over a matter of days rather than months or years.
The concept of justification by faith, what does that really mean?
Justification by faith means that because God wants to put people right, he wants people of every sort. And in the New Testament, it's clear that this isn't simply for the Jews. It isn't simply for the ancient chosen people. It's actually for everyone. And so even though people are right outside the covenant, God can and does bring them in through the gospel of Jesus, through the powerful message of Jesus and his death and resurrection, which is the heart of the gospel. And that when that is proclaimed, strangely, the Spirit works in people's lives so that then they find they believe it, even though it may seem ridiculous. In a sense, it is to believe that this man who was crucified is alive again and doing stuff. And then when somebody believes, then God, if you like, says, that person is part of my family. He or she is forgiven. They are accepted, even whatever their moral background, whatever their ethnic background, whatever their social class, etc. That's what justification is all about.
One of the great patristic sayings is Tertullian, credo quod absurdum, I believe because it is absurd.
Yeah, yeah.
And is he referring there to...
It's partly the resurrection, but it's more than that for Tertullian. I don't remember exactly where that comes in his works, but it's obviously a famous saying. But Tertullian is kind of, he's a bullish theologian. He's taking the bull by the horns, if you like. He's saying, okay, it's absurd, and actually that's why I believe it, because if it was just a kind of easygoing bit of philosophy, then it wouldn't be worthy of God. But if God is the creator, then you would expect extraordinary things to happen if God is at work.
The crucifixion was foreordained. Judas is merely acting on the basis of a scenario that is invariant, and he's got to play his role. And Jesus knows that he's going to his bloody death.
Jesus believes it is his vocation to go on announcing that God is becoming king in this way, even though he knows that that will, in fact, pull down the house on top of him. But he believes, as a good first century Jew who has read his Psalms, has read his Isaiah, has read his Daniel and Zechariah and so on, he believes that God will use his own death in the process of rescuing and transforming not just Israel, but the whole world. Now, the mystery of God's sovereignty and human responsibility remains one of the deepest mysteries there is. And I don't think at any point I could, or anyone that I know could say what was actually going on in the mind of Judas Iscariot. Judas, he bears this glorious name, Judah. It's one of the great royal names. And Judah is a tragedy, a man who was a trusted associate of Jesus, who at the last minute suddenly turns and goes the other way.
But he's needed. He's a basic part of the story.
Well,
he's a basic part of the foreordained plot.
Now, I think, in a sense, that's to try to put a rationalistic, almost machine-like framework on a story which is much bigger than that. I mean, in a novel, is a character actually predetermined to do this? When you read a novel, the characters, of course, they've come out of the mind of the creator, but actually they seem to have, and novelists will tell you that their characters have a freedom, and that if you try and constrain them, the novel won't work.
This activates in me a question that I sort of lodge in the back of my mind, just reading some stuff about you in the last day or two. I saw some reference to you as being, quote, a Calvinist.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Do you consider yourself a Calvinist?
I consider myself to be Catholic, Reformed, Pentecostal, all sorts of things. I'm an Anglican. No, that would include, Reformed includes Calvin.
If you're a serious Calvinist, then you believe in predestination. There is no freedom.
Predestination doesn't mean there is no freedom. Determinism means there is no freedom. One of the great One of the great things about Christian theology is that it's like philosophy, only it's in three dimensions instead of two. And so that whereas philosophy, you've got determinism at one end of the scale, free will at the other end of the scale, Christian theology has always said, no, you've got to triangulate. There's something else going on. There are other dimensions. And people routinely within our world have tried to flatten out theology and make it easier by putting it back into two dimensions. You just can't do that.
You would agree that the ultimate doctrine which defines Christianity, and without which, that if you don't believe it, you're not really a Christian. If it hadn't happened this way, there would be no Christianity, is the resurrection.
If Jesus didn't rise again, then, frankly, I've been wasting all my life, and it's been fun, but it's basically beside the point.
Before we come to the resurrection, as we will shortly, we're going to pause in just a moment for the usual reasons, but what is to be said about the crucifixion itself?
The crucifixion itself was simultaneously the most appalling act of murder and the brutality of a state regime that was determined to crush all opposition, and, astonishingly, the most amazing act of generous love that the world has ever seen. John puts it like this. He says, Jesus, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And John means to the uttermost. He went as far as love could go. And somehow, and this is, again, it's like a piece of music where two great themes come together and you think this is going to be a discord. And in a sense it is, but then only art and music can really get at it. We've got this act of brutality, and simultaneously it's to be interpreted as an act of divine love.
But they killed him.
They did.
At Calvary, and on the third day he rose.
On the third day he rose again, and frankly, if that didn't happen, I cannot explain, as a historian, the rise of early Christianity.
And we come to the resurrection directly after we pause. And then we continue with N.T. Wright, drawing from this very powerful new book, Simply Jesus, A New Vision of Who He Was, What He Did, and Why He Matters.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to N.T. Wright, the former Bishop of Durham in the UK and a bishop eternally. What do you do as a bishop when you're not bishoping?
Well, I haven't retired. I've gone to a university job in St. Andrews.
You're an academic.
So the bishop bit is kind of, in a sense, dormant, just like when I was being a bishop, the professor bit was being dormant. So I've spent my life oscillating between two vocations, and I've never been able to make
you
up my mind.
You could go back to bishoping again if you chose.
If they asked me, yeah. Which hopefully they won't. No, I mean, I'm too old to go back and do another job. I'm doing
You're only about 59 or 60.
62.
62. Yes. Wow, well, you are. Now then, to the New Testament and an account of the resurrection. What account do you choose?
This is from John's Gospel, and it's John's Gospel chapter 20, and it's my namesake Thomas, who wasn't around the first time Jesus appeared to the disciples, and so you've
this
asked me
doubting
to,
Thomas.
Doubting Thomas, absolutely. And you've asked me to read from the King James Version, so
please.
That's what I'll do. Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. The other disciples therefore said unto him, we've seen the Lord. But he said unto them, except I shall see in his hands the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, and thrust my hand into his side, I will not believe. And after 8 days again his disciples were within, and Thomas with them. Then came Jesus, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst, and said, peace be unto you. Then saith he to Thomas, reach hither thy finger, and behold my hands, and reach hither thy hand, and thrust it into my side. Be not faithless, but believing. And Thomas answered and said unto him, my Lord and my God. Jesus saith unto him, Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are they that have not seen, and yet have believed.
Yeah, a beautiful passage.
A wonderful passage.
The story itself, though, begins, that is the story of the discovery of the empty tomb, begins with, it's a little bit unclear who comes to the tomb. Mary, the mother of Jesus?
No, it's not Mary, the mother of Jesus.
Rather, Mary Magdalene.
Mary Magdalene, yes.
And some other women. There's no way specified.
Yeah, but Mary Magdalene is highlighted, and that's fascinating because in the ancient world, women were not regarded as credible witnesses.
Yeah.
And indeed, when we see the formal version of the early resurrection tradition in Paul's writings, the women have been airbrushed out of it, but they're there in all the gospel accounts, and that to me is a sign that these must be very early accounts, because nobody would have made it up like that.
I have something I want to play for you. This is a program, this is an excerpt from a program that we did here some 11 years ago.
The crucial
program
question
titled The Quest for Jesus. Religious scholars John White, he a member of the Jesus Seminar, Bart Ehrman, a former fundamentalist who has lost the faith but is a biblical scholar, surely, and Scott McKnight, who's a good a pastor, evangelical here in town. And here's a conversation about the nature of the resurrection. Did it really happen, is the basic question.
The crucial question is, what happened after Jesus' death? Was Christianity constructed as a way of accommodating to the disappointment, the confusion of the fact that he was crucified?
I think you've asked a good question, and I think it dovetails nicely with what Bart's book is about when it comes to historical methodology and historiography. And I think Bart makes a major point in his book that the historical method cannot demonstrate a miracle. And I would contend that neither then should it outlaw or deny a miracle simply on the basis that, I think according to his historical method, miracles are not a part of historical explanations.
You are thereby also attesting, I gather, in personal terms, that for you, the miracle of the resurrection did really occur.
I do. But let me say, as a historian, here's the kinds of considerations that I think, as a historian, we can ask. We could ascertain, on the basis of evidence, that the tomb was empty. Second, that no one was able to produce the body after the so-called death and resurrection, or non-resurrection. That many people claim to encounter Jesus after his death. That the absence of collusion about the resurrection's event, which means why we have all these discrepancies, is perhaps indicative of independent testimony rather than getting together and making something up. And that I think we could also consider that many of those who did claim to encounter Jesus on other grounds were reliable people. So I would ask, while I would say that a historian properly probably can't say God raised Jesus from the dead, historical method allows us to unravel evidence in such a way that maybe we are led to explanations other than what empiricism would teach
that
us.
Argument, if you'll forgive a rather secular note, rather reminds me of the argument about UFOs. They must be real. Jimmy Carter says he saw one.
I didn't know that Jimmy Carter
he did. Yes, he did.
Let me interject that I agree with some of what Scott's saying, but it sounds to me like he's taking back with one hand what he's giving with the other. I think that, in fact, as he said in my book, I argue that you can't establish on historical grounds whether a miracle happened, because the historical disciplines just don't give us that kind of evidence. But then Scott went on and listed a number of reasons that he thinks historically the resurrection did happen.
No, I didn't say that. I said these are evident. These are things that historians could say legitimately.
Yes, but it has no bearing on whether Jesus was raised or not.
But it could lead to the explanation. I would agree with you. Miracle is explanation rather than...
I would disagree also with several of the things. I mean, I don't know. I don't think we know for a fact that there was an empty tomb 3 days after Jesus was buried. The traditions about an empty tomb come to us from sources that were written decades later. We simply don't know whether it was widely known that Jesus' tomb was empty. We don't know where he was buried, if he was buried in an individual tomb, or, as would be more likely in that context, typically what happened with crucified people is they were either left on the cross to rot, or else they were thrown into a common tomb, and they would have disintegrated the body would decompose in fairly short order, so that, of course, there would be no body to produce. I'm not saying that Jesus wasn't buried in the tomb. I just don't think we know that for a fact.
I think even more importantly, Bart, is I don't think the earliest Christians focused on that fact. I mean, the fact of the resurrection was independent of the physicality of the resurrection, of empty tomb or resuscitated corpse. The earliest experiences are some type of ecstatic or visionary experiences, whatever they were, of Paul and Peter. And even the later Gospels talk about something other than ordinary physicality. This is something like a phantasm or apparition that appears and disappears. So,
I would agree with some of that, especially. I think that the Apostle Paul, who's our first evidence that Jesus was raised from the dead, he's the first one who mentions it, doesn't say anything about an empty tomb.
Of course, Paul says it before the Synoptic Gospels
That's right.
were written.
That's
he?
Exactly right. But the thing,
the Pauline epistles are really the earliest written works that later comprised the
New
Testament.
That's right. They're written about 10 or 15 years before our Gospels.
Yeah.
But that doesn't take into consideration that the research in Synoptic Gospels would argue that the Gospels that we have were not all of a sudden produced completely in 70, 80 A.D., but they are the result of what would be a very typical Jewish transmission mm-hmm. of traditions about Jesus.
Oh, yes, one would have to assume there was an oral tradition that was there
okay.
From the death of Christ, the death of Jesus on.
So when we say that the Synoptics are after Paul, but they are also, in a sense, before
yeah.
Paul.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is no body, actual body, at all in Mark's gospel, and the fact that the tomb is supposedly discovered empty is not convincing evidence for those first women. They did not agree this proved the resurrection. So even the gospels, or some of them, do not assume necessarily that this is a proof.
Well, what was found in the tomb or near the tomb seems to vary from gospel to gospel, even with regard to the archangels who are standing by
yes.
or are not standing by, whether they're there at all and what their number is and so on.
Whether there's two men or one man or yeah. whether there's an angel.
And then there's
all.
That one non-canonical gospel that you write about.
Gospel of Peter.
The Gospel of Peter, in which we have a story of a far more gargantuan quality.
Yes, oh, it's terrific. The Gospel of Peter actually narrates Jesus emerging from the tomb. The story allegedly written by Peter, although everybody, I think, agrees that it's a
forgery. This goes
forgery.
To the second century.
Second century, probably. It narrates an account that says that there were two angels that descended from heaven, entered into the tomb, and then the bystanders watched three figures emerge from the tomb, two of them standing up with their heads reaching up to the heavens, and supporting a third person whose head reaches above the heavens, and then emerging out behind them comes the cross itself. A voice comes from heaven saying, "Have you preached to those who have fallen asleep?" And the cross replies, "Yes." It's the only account we have of the actual resurrection event itself, probably from the second century.
It did go on for considerably longer than that. Apparently, there's a good deal of argument as to how you are to view the resurrection. These are three people all deeply involved in Christianity.
Yeah. But, well, they're not that deeply involved in Christianity. Two of those, I think, were perhaps either ex-Christians or agnostics. Scott McKnight is a practicing Christian. I don't know John White, but Bart Ehrman, I know.
Bart Ehrman says he's a post-Christian.
He's a post-Christian. But, I mean, to be honest, it's very frustrating to be listening to that conversation.
I saw you writing.
There's so many misunderstandings and I think misrepresentations, actually. There are several signs that the stories in the Gospels, even though they may have been written down much later, or we don't actually know that. Mm. This is merely a scholarly hypothesis. It's quite possible, physically, that the Gospels were all written in the 40s. It's quite possible they were all written in the 90s. We don't know that. This is just scholarly tradition. But at the heart of it is this blessed word, resurrection, itself. Resurrection is not a word for a visionary apparition. It's not a word for "I feel that Jesus' cause continues" or anything like that. Resurrection, the Greek word anastasis in the ancient world, meant somebody who had been thoroughly dead being thoroughly alive again. And the Jewish people had this tradition of resurrection, which came out in some strands of Judaism, particularly the Pharisees, very emphatically saying that God will raise the dead, and they didn't mean that they'll be ghosts or apparitions or anything like that. I mean, the world was full of stories of ghosts and apparitions. If they'd wanted to say, "We've seen an apparition," they had language to say that. They didn't. They said, "He's been raised from the dead." And they were remarkably unanimous about that. And the thing is about the empty tomb. Yes, an empty tomb by itself doesn't prove anything, because grave robbery happened. Likewise, an apparition or a seeing of somebody you take to be Jesus by itself doesn't prove anything, because people know that there are such things as apparitions. What counts is when you get those two together, and when you get the two together, then people say, "Oh my goodness, this is actually different." And that's what was going on with the resurrection. if you don't have the bodily resurrection, it's historically impossible to explain the rise of Christianity.
It's a cruelty, but I must, at the moment, call a halt, quite temporary, as we go to the newsroom for an update, and we'll just pick it up directly where we're leaving it at this moment. When we return to NT Right, after the update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to N.T. Wright, drawing from his remarkably interesting and moving volume, Simply Jesus, A New Vision of Who He Was, What He Did, and Why He Matters. Let us face the fact that your view of the resurrection is an orthodox or a fundamentalist or an evangelical view, whatever characterizing term. But there are other churchmen, including those in the Anglican Communion, who will not argue for the actual physicality of the resurrection, but we'll say it's poetic, it's an approximation, it's in a different mode of expression. But in modern terms, we can still understand that there's something sacrificial, something redemptive, something eternal about it all.
Yeah, and no doubt there are many people in church who manage to talk rubbish just like there are in many other walks of life, like politics and economics.
Including
and
among the Anglicans.
Absolutely, yes, yes. I mean, to be honest, this is nothing to do with being evangelical or fundamentalist or anything. The Christian church from the very beginning has made it quite clear that the reason we exist is because God raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. What's happened in the last 200 years particularly is that people have said, oh, now that we've got modern science, we know that that sort of thing can't happen, so yeah, we have to translate it out. The ridiculous thing is that actually everyone in the first century knew that dead people don't rise. Homer knew it. Virgil knew it. Pliny knew it. One of the great plays of Aeschylus, he says, that when a man dies and his blood is spilt on the ground, there is no resurrection. They all knew. Christianity was born in a world where its central claim was known to be false, and the Christians went on making it. The question we have to ask is, why did those Christians make that claim? Because if you'd said to Paul or Mark or Peter or whoever, actually, of course, what really happened, my dear fellow, is that not that something physical happened, but that you felt that Jesus' cause continues, or that actually God is still good to you or something, they'd say, no, you don't understand. And the reason for that is actually a deeply Jewish reason. And the Jewish reason is because God made the world and God likes that stuff, and that other forms of religion are an escape from the world, whereas the Jewish and Christian vision is the renewal of the world, and that the resurrection of Jesus is not a kind of a messy oddity within the old creation. It is the central feature of the new creation. And it's a big claim, but if that isn't true, then first century Christianity, fifth century Christianity, whatever, falls to the ground.
What is rather special about your treatment of these matters of resurrection is not that you insist upon the literal and significant physical resurrection of Jesus, but rather what you've got to say about the coming resurrection at the end of historical time, so to speak, or at least upon the second coming of Jesus, in which you are, you're contradicting the book that I read, Nel Mezzo del Cammin di Nostra Vita. When I read Dante, I learned that there is heaven and hell, and Dante personifies hell in all of its complexity. And you, of course, are talking about final things for the lives of ordinary human beings and telling us, in essence, that those concepts are not truly Christian, and neither heaven nor hell, as commonly conceived, even in much of our great art, including Dante, both the Paradiso and the Inferno, that's not the way it is.
I love Dante, and I love the Sistine Chapel, but those, Michelangelo's great work, but those are characteristic of a particular form of late medieval piety, of a way of talking about the end, which is actually not how half of Christendom to this day sees it. I'll tell you
most Christians,
story.
When their beloved die, they take some reassurance or some consolation in the thought, well, he's going to heaven, he's in heaven now.
Yeah, and the way that the Bible puts it, for instance,
you're saying that doesn't happen.
No, I'm not saying it doesn't happen at all. I'm saying that that's only a temporary stage, and that one day God is going to make the whole world over again. This is again a deeply Jewish idea.
What's temporary is not a trip To heaven, which becomes a lasting location.
No, precisely. Heaven is, as I've said again many times, heaven is important, but it isn't the end of the world. And that the final end in the Bible, in the Christian Bible, is new heavens and new earth, which are joined together. And this is not a Platonic fly to the alone to the lone. It's actually new creation. And the interesting thing is this, interesting story. 3 years ago, I was the Anglican delegate at the Synod of Bishops in Rome, which was fascinating. And we had a big service at the end of that in the Sistine Chapel. I was sat next to the Greek Orthodox representative. And he looked at that great wall with that picture of heaven and hell and so on. And he said, I simply don't understand that. We in the East do not do eschatology, the last things, that way. And I'm actually with him on this, that Dante picture, that Michelangelo picture, which has dominated Western consciousness, not least in America, American Christianity, where believing in heaven and hell is almost the same as believing in God, it's just not like that. God is going to remake the whole thing and raise people from the dead.
So let's talk about that. Let's do eschatology. You're saying this is true Christian eschatology, and it surely is an a vision of the final things that you lay out very, very vividly in the last chapter of this book, actually. What happens?
What happens is that in the Bible, heaven and earth are made for one another, and that eventually, though at the moment they are opaque, at least we can't see into heaven, maybe heaven can see into us, I don't know, but eventually they will be brought together without a veil between them. Jesus will be the central feature of that. Sometimes the New Testament talks about Jesus reappearing, sometimes it talks about him coming, because from our point of view, it will be like a coming. But this isn't Jesus the spaceman flying down through millions of miles of cosmic space. The fact is that heaven is not far away from us at any given moment. Heaven and earth intermingle and meet and merge in a variety of ways, and one day they will come together for good in a great act of renewal. The only reason I believe this is because I believe Jesus was raised from the dead. But what I'm trying to do is to chase through what the New Testament writers say on that basis about what God is going to do to the whole creation. God will do for the whole cosmos at the last what he did for Jesus at Easter.
What portions of the New Testament are the most significant for the full outline of that vision?
The 8th chapter of the letter to the Romans, the 15th chapter of the first letter to the Corinthians, and the last two chapters of the book of Revelation. But actually, if I had to choose, I would take John's Gospel, chapters 20 and 21, along with, because it's deeply personal, and it shows that this isn't just a theory about the cosmos, a kind of a big floppy thing. It's very intimate about, here's Mary crying at the tomb and Jesus meets her. Here's Thomas, who actually doesn't believe it, and as we read before, Jesus says, okay, Thomas, here's the evidence. And here's Peter, who has disgraced himself and let Jesus down, and Jesus asks him 3 times, do you love me? And Peter struggles to say it. He uses a different word. He says, actually, yes, Lord, I'm your friend. And then Jesus says, are you my friend? I think that's a wonderful moment when Jesus says, okay, Peter, that's where you are. That's where we'll start. And I think for many people, perhaps for many people listening, there's a sense, I'm not sure if I can believe this. I'm not sure if I'm really on board with Jesus. And I think Jesus meets people there where they are. And that's different for everybody, as it is in those 3 stories. So I want the big theory in Paul and Revelation. I want the big picture. But I also want, because it's absolutely central, Jesus dealing intimately, the risen, alive Jesus dealing intimately with real human beings where they are.
And in that final time, as you interpret traditional and true Christianity, we will all rise from the dead, except, both the living and the dead, or the quick and the dead.
Paul talks about the people.
And we will reconstitute physically.
Yeah. Now, this is an interesting one, because in the one major chapter on this, which is 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul talks about a transformed physicality. He says we need to be changed, because at the moment, it's very hard for us to imagine a non-corruptible physicality. You know, I'm sitting in the studio with you. Here's a table. This is solid wood. But if you leave it long enough, it will rot. And so will everything else around here. And so will our bodies and so on. But what we're talking about is a physicality that won't do that, and that is a new creation, like Jesus' own body. Paul says Christ being raised from the dead will never die again. Death has no more power, sovereignty, dominion over him. And so we're talking about a physicality which is like more real, more solid. You know, we sometimes say of somebody who's been sick, poor old so-and-so, who's just a shadow of his former self. But if the resurrection is true, we are at the moment just a shadow of our future selves. That's
the
promise.
And after the day of resurrection, because it's all one great final event, and millions and millions and millions of formerly dead are now physically reconstituted.
That is the promise.
And what happens in life after that?
Well, we're not told very much. All we're told is, I've often said to people, all language about the future is a set of signposts pointing into a fog. They are true signposts, but they don't give us a photographic reproduction of what it's going to be like when we're there. However, since they're all signposts based on the character of God himself, we can trust that God in his new creation... I mean, the present creation is full of beauty and power and glory, and the new one is going to be even more so.
You're not worried about the demographic overload?
I'm not worried about the demographic overload. More than half the people who have ever been alive throughout history are alive now.
To be sure.
So actually, all the present population of the world could get together on Long Island. It wouldn't be much room, but they would be able to do it. So actually, and if God is going to remake the world, you know, we are talking in imponderables here. But if God is God, then I actually don't think God's going to be too bothered by a question of whether there's geographical
what's
space.
What's he going to do, however? I raise this question just as we're about to sneak away for some commercials, but you will welcome this question, I'm sure. What is God going to do about the Buddhists, the Hindus, the Sikhs, the Shintos, to be sure, the Muslims? And if you will permit, what about my poor little group, the Jews? What sort of destination do they have? Do they get reconstituted physically on the occasion of Jesus' return in the second coming? And I shall look forward to that answer for the next 3 minutes, and then we return.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to N.T. Wright. So, what will happen to those of us who are not Christians?
It's a difficult question which has been wrestled with over many years. So, everything I say is under the rubric of this is one of the sort of half dozen really tough ones, and that's fair enough. I make no bones about it. I don't have easy answers. But it seems to me that in the New Testament, God is renewing the very nature of what it means to be human. And being human in the Bible means to reflect God's image. The way that that happens is by people actually worshipping the God in whose image they are made. And when people decide they're not going to worship God, they're not going to give God any credence, then their humanness begins to deconstruct and begins to unravel. And tragically, the last century, we saw huge unravelings of humanness in the Holocaust, in some of the great totalitarian systems which killed, murdered, maimed millions and millions of people. Now, when something like that happens, it seems to me God is not inactive. God just doesn't shrug his shoulders and say, oh, well, never mind, it was only a game. I actually love you all anyway, so you can all come out. This isn't a chess game where the pieces just go back on the board afterwards. This is real life, and for many people, real death. And so... simply to say that actually God is a kindly old grandfather who will, well, you know, was it Voltaire who said, Dieu pardonnera, c'est son métier, God will forgive, that's his job. The Jewish vision of God is not like that at all. It's of a God who wants to put things right. It's as a justice as well as a love. And the Christian vision reinforces that. So it seems to me if somebody colludes with their own dehumanization by turning away from God, and actually turning towards all sorts of destructive kinds of life, then because of who God is, God must say that is not the way to life with a capital L.
Well, the truly evil don't have a redemptive end to their lives. God is not that silly. Granted.
Well,
but,
yeah,
but what about the truly decent, ordinary human beings who happen not to be Christian? What about my father, who died some 10 years ago?
He was a
decent, good man. He was Jewish, but not even all that. He was deeply Jewish in culture, came from Europe, but was essentially a secular man.
The main thing to say is I'm very glad I'm not God, because I do not have to make that decision. And I did not know your father, but I know many people who fit the description that you've just outlined. And of course, we none of us know the secrets of everybody else's hearts. We just don't do that. Even the people to whom we're closest, our nearest and dearest, are often a deep mystery to us. And so we have to say this is actually God's business, and God has a way of doing business with people. However, sometimes, C.S. Lewis was awfully good on this, sometimes there's a sense that even though somebody hasn't actually explicitly embraced the Christian faith, their response to the highest wisdom and truth that they know has what, from a Christian point of view, looks like a Christian shape to it. Now, some theologians have explored that in terms of people being, as it were, anonymous Christians. I'm not sure I want to say that, but there may be something to be said down that line.
By the way, on the Day of Judgment, what happens to those who don't make the cut? Where do they go?
This is all metaphorical language, of course. In other words, I don't know what the nature of the reality is for somebody who has said, I'm actually not going to worship God. It seems to me there is a sort of state of being a creature that once was human but now isn't, which is a horrible thing to think. I don't enjoy
there are those other millions and millions and millions who do worship God, but they don't worship God in the Christian mode.
Well, the question is, who is God? The word God in Western culture has come to be univocal, as though it's just God is God is God is God. In fact, as they knew perfectly well in the ancient world, there's a world full of gods. There's all sorts of different gods, and some of those gods are pretty terrifying and not very nice at all. And the point about the Christian vision of God is that actually we don't know who God is until we look at Jesus, and then we begin to discover, and the true God is rather different. So it's possible, and sadly many Christians actually worship something they call God, but who isn't really very like Jesus at all. And so this is a very murky area, and it's hard. Again, I am not God, I don't want to be God. I'm not going to draw lines in the sand on some arbitrary principle.
When the believing Jew, that is, believing in Judaism, and communicant of Judaism, says, Shema Yisroel, Ad Hashem Eloheinu, Ad Hashem Echod, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Isn't he speaking of the same God that Christians
are
speaking of?
Yes, and it's very interesting that in the New Testament, that very prayer, that lovely ancient Jewish prayer, which is a noble and fine prayer, is taken up and applied to Jesus. Paul picks that up in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, chapter 8, verse 6, and he says, for us there is one God, the Father, and one Lord, Jesus Christ. And he's embracing Jesus within the Jewish doctrine of the one God.
It seems to me you could fit into your doctrine at least a caveat clause for Jews and Muslims. we are the three peoples of the book, supposedly.
But which book? That's a very interesting question.
It's a Muslim concept, the people of the book.
I know, but the trouble is that the Quran is a very different book, both to the Tanakh, the Jewish Bible, and to the Old and New Testaments of the Christian
Bible. Jesus has prophetic status in the Quran.
I know, but the trouble is that in the New Testament, he emphatically has more than prophetic status.
Sure.
And the main thing that the Quran, you know what it says in Arabic around the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem? It says there is one God and he does not have a son. That's a political statement, we won and you guys lost, but it is also a theological statement that's part of the Muslim vision of the one God, that he not only doesn't but couldn't have a son, and that he could not die on a cross. It is central to Christianity that the God in whom we believe loved the world so much that he came in the person of his son to die for us, and that's something which some Muslims are hugely attracted to, that, but the Quran does actually rule it out.
This has been, to me, a fascinating discussion, and we are shortly going to the newsroom for another quick round of the latest news. But before that, it is now time to invite telephone calls and email. We're opening the phone lines at this instant. And though time is a little bit on the short side, get in there quickly if you have a question to raise or a thought you want to share. Though the shorts should be, the thoughts rather should be, I'm combining two words there, conflating. The thoughts should be short, shortly expressed with brevity. 312-591-7200 is the phone number. We await your calls. 312-591-7200. And if you're listening over the internet at some greater distance and in another country or up in Saskatchewan or down in Yucatan and want to join us, the best way would be, of course, via email. The email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. And for phones, 312-591-7200. On to your contributions directly after these words.
Milt Rosenberg and extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And we will go directly to the phones, 312-591-7200, and the area code, as I say, 312-591-7200. And here is the first caller. John has joined us. Good evening.
Good evening. My question is, what is your guest's opinion of the modern way that Americans practice Christianity? For example, in my city, the church used a lot of its tithe to pay for the building, to pay for the air conditioning. And then you see $40,000-$50,000 cars sitting outside, $200 or $300 suits. When Jesus was asked by the rich man in the scripture, what can I do to be guaranteed a place in heaven? He said, sell all that you have. All that you have and give to the poor.
Mm-hmm. You did say that.
That's a great question. Jesus didn't say that to everybody, but he certainly did say it to some people. And the early church wrestled with that because some of them decided to sell up and live as a commune, as it were. And you can see that tracking on through the early church and on for the next two or three centuries, where the key thing is that the early Christians lived as family. And that meant that if somebody was in need, others pitched in. And that remains a wonderful aspiration, and I think the church has often forgotten that. And yes, when I look at some British churches, but especially in America, of course, America being one of the wealthiest countries, if not the wealthiest at the moment, sometimes things are spent on church buildings and so on, which one wishes were done otherwise. It's difficult to point the finger because, you know, people could look at my life and say, well, what sort of car do you drive and all that sort of thing. And so it is a matter for individual consciences, but I think we are getting wake-up calls all over the world at the moment in terms of where we are economically, and we really have to address those issues.
As the Bishop of Durham, you lived in a castle.
I'd lived in one little bit of an ancient castle.
Yeah.
And
it's called Auckland Castle.
Auckland Castle, correct. But it was... people used to say things about the ivory tower. It was more the ivory basement, really. But the part of the point of living in the northeast of England is that it's a very depressed area, and actually the people all around were hugely relieved that their bishop lived, even if it was only in one little bit of an old castle, because it actually gave them a bit of a lift. This was the old mining communities, and we did a huge amount in and for those communities, and nobody actually saw that. This wasn't a kind of an isolated affluence or anything like that.
Back to the phones, 312-591-7200, and next up is Bob, who joins us at WGN Radio. Good evening, sir.
Yes, good evening. Thank you. I'd like to say what a pleasure it is to hear some brilliant men discuss reverently this wonderful topic.
Thank you for that compliment, and let's proceed.
Well, my comment was on your recent discussion about where do good Muslims go, or do good Jewish people go to heaven, or good Buddhists. My understanding is that Jesus answered that. When he told his disciples he was leaving them, they said, Lord, where are you going? We don't know. We can't follow. And he said, there are many mansions in my Father's house. And I believe what that means is that through Christianity, we get to see God the Father, because Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. But through my interpretation of the other mansions, there is a special place for good human beings.
That's very interesting. You know, this is a trivial matter, I suppose, but I know that I've read someplace that the guys who did the scholarship on the King James Version mistranslated there, that the proper translation would be, "In my Father's house there are many tents."
Well, the Greek word is mone. This is in John chapter 14,
yeah.
And we can't get into all the detail of that now. But let me say to both your callers so far, we are still persisting with what seems to me the wrong view, which is that the aim of the whole game is to go to heaven ultimately, whereas in the New Testament, the ultimate aim is not a disembodied heaven somewhere else, but the renewal of heaven and earth, and they're joining together. And I would urge your callers to read the last two chapters of the book of Revelation, where heaven and earth come together. But having said that, the mone, the many mansions, the many dwelling places, tents, tabernacles, that word is used for a kind of a way station. It's a wayside inn where you stay while you're on the way somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think it has anything to do with there being a differentiation that there'll be some of these for Jews and some of these for Muslims and some of them for... That's simply not the way Jesus is talking at that time. But of course, Jesus does say, "I am the way, the truth, and the life" in John chapter 14. And that is, of course, one of the central Christian claims.
When you speak of the joining of heaven and earth and a time not... beyond that, not specified, but somehow in which all will be different and all will be perfected. That evokes, does it not, even for the present world, the necessity for discovering the social good and doing the social good as part of your religious life.
Absolutely. That's critical. If you think that the name of the game is simply to go off somewhere else to a disembodied place, then what's the fuss to make the present world any better? But if you believe that in Jesus and his resurrection, God's new creation has already begun and that one day it will be completed, then we live between the prototype moment and the final fulfillment moment. And by God's Spirit, through Jesus, we are enabled to do things which make new creation happen in the present. You can see that going on in South Africa with Desmond Tutu and the Commission for Truth and Reconciliation. You can see it going on with the remission of global debt in various countries and so on, where serious major new initiatives have been taken which actually do bring the new creation life of God into the world.
And if Anglican divines are interested in bringing the new creation into fruition even now in the name of Jesus, then how does that translate into present British political politics or British political social issues?
That's a great question. And the Archbishop of Canterbury wrote a piece in the Financial Times, which I flew over here on Wednesday, and it was in Wednesday morning's FT, and I just read it. And he is taking counsel from some of the leading economists around, and he's picking up on the theme which George Soros and Bill Gates have put out, which is the thing which is called the Tobin tax. Now, I know there was an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago basically rubbishing it, but this is one way of saying that the financial systems are getting out of control. I speak as somebody who has a brother who's a senior banker in the UK, and that it's time actually to find ways of making money serve the interests of the whole community and not simply the shareholders of the big banks.
What you say now distresses me a bit. I am a political or economic conservative, and I came to that after many, many years of being something else. In the wonderful phrase of Irving Kristol, a neoconservative is somebody, as a former liberal who got mugged on the way to reality. I find the Archbishop, your friend, to be rather mistakenly and rather foolishly leftist, or tilted in the left direction on all the wrong issues, including his hostility towards capitalism, which he voiced only today. I was reading the Telegraph.
Oh, right.
There's a story only today in which he's tapping the wrists or banging on the wrists of the bankers and the capitalists and so on. Dreadful, dreadful. Even worse than that is his endorsement of the need for establishing Sharia law in England.
No. Well, this has to be put to bed.
All right.
Sharia law in regard to mortgages is already part of the British financial law. Gordon Brown did that several years ago when the Muslim community said, look, we want to be part of this society, but we have to be able to do it this way. And, you know, when Rowan said what he did, he was simply acknowledging the reality that was already there, and he was not at all suggesting that,
Sharia, not Sharia for all English persons. But Sharia as a separate tradition of law for those who are Muslim but living in England, in the UK.
But this was in the specific cases of things like economics where it actually makes sense, and the then Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, had already done it, had already brought those things into...
And also, I guess you don't know this, but George Soros, in fact, is an appointed agent of the devil. I think he's one of the most evil people in the world.
Well, I'm very glad you... It's interesting because I was really rather careful to say that I wasn't playing God earlier, and it sounds to me as though you now are.
Well, at least with regard to knowing who the enemy is. I think... No, I truly think...
And what about Bill Gates? Because he has supported this plan too. But I mean,
decent fellow.
That's kind of you to say so. I wouldn't myself say that this Tobin tax is the solution to all ills. And it seems to me as well that saying, are you for or against capitalism is like, you know, are you at the moment for or against breathing? I live in the Western world and the Western world works like this. I merely observe that in the Old Testament, the Tanakh, and in the Quran, it is forbidden to take interest on money because you're supposed to make money out of doing things and making things, not simply out of manipulating money itself. And we have got so far away from that in the Western world that it doesn't surprise me that we have major problems.
Well, I must remind you that a great scholar, whose work I'm sure you know, namely Max Weber, in The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, points out that Luther made capitalism possible.
Well, that may well be. There's a very interesting history of ideas question to run there,
to
actually
sure.
from before Luther as well. But I think whatever we say about the analysis, I think most people in the Western world say that we're not doing it right at the moment. And the trouble is there's such huge vested interests that even stop the question getting on. I mean, I'll give you an example. I and others have campaigned for years for the Jubilee Project, which is the dropping of major debt for third world nations where there were stupid dictators two generations ago who took out huge, enormous loans. And some of those countries, they can't go bankrupt, so they are still paying compound interest on top of compound interest, and this has ruined the economies of several countries. Now, some they have had their debts remitted. Tanzania is a good example, and that's enabled them to go forwards. Now, whenever I've argued this, or Rowan has argued it, people have come back, bankers and people in the Daily Telegraph in London, said, oh, how ridiculous, this is such a silly idea, we can't possibly remit debts, they have to know that they've got to pay up. Then, what happened in 2008? We had the rich bankers, we had the rich industrialists, all suddenly going to the government, cap in hand, saying, oh dear, we seem to have been a bit silly. Please will you bail us out? And the governments gave them zillions of pounds, dollars, and now they're back at it again. In other words, the very rich did for the very rich what they had refused to do for the very poor. So let's not have any nonsense about this is impossible. We've just done it for the already rich. Why can't we now do it for the poorest of the poor?
Of course, you're also
is that not a great Jewish mandate?
Possibly so. You're also describing a kind of dynamic which was operative on this side of the ocean.
Yeah.
With this current administration, which bailed out the whole auto industry, supposedly, and killed off one banking group and buoyed up the rest of it.
I know, and that was very bizarre.
With about $1 trillion.
Yes, I know. And so it would actually be possible for us to do major good around the world, but, you know, for some reason, well, I know why, it's because of greed, basically, that people don't want to do that for the poorest of the poor, and they hope that the cry of the poor will be forgotten. And I'm here to tell you there's some of us that haven't forgotten that.
Well, God would not object, surely, to our helping the Greeks get through their current ticket.
But you see, that's a problem about Europe. The European...
That's why I mentioned it.
The European problem, I mean, about Europe with a sort of a big capital E, the European project was a kind of modernist dream of the post-war world in Germany and France, that if we put everybody together under the one umbrella, then it would all work. Sadly, since then, we've had post-modernity, which says, actually, the little stories are different from each other, and they've got to be given their place in the sun. I think the attempt to put everything from Greece or even Turkey across to Ireland under one roof is just a very tricky project.
At any rate, I know that you agree with me, whether on a theological basis or otherwise, that capitalism may not be the best of all systems, but it's the only one that works at all for us. And therefore, we will do our brief reverence for capitalism one last time tonight, and then directly back to N.T. Wright and to your calls to him on 312-591-7200.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And as we go down towards the wire with another 10 minutes or so left, I do want to read you one email, at least, that has come in as soon as I can enlarge it and bring it up on the screen. And here it is. If God is God, why couldn't he have given us a little more clear, definite answers to questions that largely divide us today in religious political circles, such as homosexuality, paren, is someone gay from birth or is it a choice, etc., is it a sin, etc., close paren, and the subject of abortion? And with all the different religions, couldn't he have made it undeniable which religious belief is the true belief? It seems we have so many arguments over these three things. So frustrating.
It may be frustrating, but if God is God, then God made human beings in his image, and that means God wanted us to be people, not puppets. And the danger with saying if God is God, he should have made it easier, is we'd have all ended up as rather trivial little puppets with no actual work to do. It's like when you write a novel, I've never written a novel, but I wouldn't be surprised if you have, but when people write novels, they have to allow the reader space to do the work. Otherwise, it's mere didactic stuff. You've got to be able to think into it. And I think God made a world in which he wanted us to grow up and actually study and think and pray and love and wait and be patient and look around. Not one where the answers just grew on trees and so it was blindingly obvious. That would have been a very trivial world, and we would have all been rather trivial little people.
And back to the phones. 312-591-7200. Jim is next. Good evening, sir.
Hi. I have a couple questions for the guest. If he believes there's a literal physical resurrection, why is it that there are so many instances of the risen Christ being unrecognizable to the disciples? And also, why are there two conflicting traditions about the first appearance, a Jerusalem tradition and a Galilee tradition?
Good questions. The first one, the unrecognizable Jesus, or at least not instantly recognizable. The fascinating thing is, in the Jewish traditions about resurrection, it seems to go one of two ways. Either it's basically a resuscitation, as in the books of the Maccabees, or it's to a quite different sort of new body, as you find in say, Second Baruch. But what you find in early Christianity is that there's a change to a non-corruptible physicality. This is something that C.S. Lewis says in his brilliant book, Miracles, where he says that if you were making up stories like this later, you wouldn't have had people who'd known Jesus and spent time with him all that time, then not instantly recognizing him. Lewis says that's actually a sign that these are true stories, even though they're very, very strange stories. A new form of physicality has come into the world. It is still physical, it is continuous with the old, but it's been transformed. And Paul talks about that transformation. And that is such explanation as one can give for the at least initial. It's like when you see, if you've seen somebody, been visiting somebody who's sick in hospital and they look so ill and haggard and a shadow of their former selves, as I said before. And then, if you suddenly met them on the street, larger than life and fully alive and fit again, you would hardly recognize them. You'd say, you're looking quite different. And I think it was something like that. There are not just two traditions. There are several different traditions about what happened on the first Easter morning. And that has often been cited as one of the examples, like when you get witnesses to a car crash, that everybody sees and remembers something slightly different. The stories do not read to me as though they've been polished, as though they've been shaped over the years. They read to me like the kind of breathless, oh my goodness, and then we saw this, and then this happened, and then something else happened. And people haven't tidied them up. These are very vivid, and I think even though they're written down later, these go back to very, very early oral tradition. And of course, in John, you have both Galilee and both Jerusalem and Galilee. So the gospel narratives are, to us, very confusing, but actually they're very rich and dense, and I think they show the signs of bearing actual eyewitness testimony.
Speaking of the narratives, particularly the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, who wrote them? We don't generally assume that they were singly authored by real people named Matthew, Mark, and Luke, do we?
Well, it's interesting. There's one of the most radical scholars in England at the moment, Maurice Casey, who I've known for many years, who says he gave up being a Christian in 1962, rather touchingly in his new book he says that. He thinks that Mark's Gospel was written by Mark in the 40s, and that Matthew's Gospel was written by Matthew in the 50s, and that Luke wrote that Luke's Gospel was Luke, the companion of Paul. That's extraordinary. It used to be only conservatives who believed that. There's now a whole new radical movement. He doesn't believe in the resurrection. He's not a Christian. But it seems to me that actually the evidence is much more open than traditions of scholarship have normally made out. I said an hour or so ago, the Gospels could actually all have been written in the 50s. They could have all been written in the 90s. We just don't have the evidence that people have imagined we do to nail them down to a particular decade. I think we need a whole new breath of fresh air through Gospel scholarship, to be honest.
We'll work in one or two more quick calls, and the next one up is Jonathan, who is on the phone with us right now, I trust. Good evening.
Yes, just really excited to be on the radio and big fan of Dr. Wright. I have this question. There seems to be these two growing camps in evangelical Christianity today, where we have like the neo-Calvinist movement, and they seem to be entrenching in one side, and then the kind of broader evangelical community kind of looking for more church tradition and more of a wideness. And I was just curious, how can these two camps come together and have a fruitful conversation without just beating each other over the head with the Bible?
Well, of course, hopefully they won't beat each other over the head with the Bible. Hopefully what they would do would be get together prayerfully and humbly around the Bible and say, please, can we actually read this together? There's nothing stopping us reading the Bible together. The problem comes when we get into our separate camps or divisions and only talk to ourselves and then lob hand grenades over the wall at one another. When I look across the Atlantic from where I normally live, I see America deeply polarized on all sorts of issues, and the polarization goes back through the fundamentalist modernist controversies. It goes back to your civil war. The rest of the world doesn't do your sort of polarization. We have other sorts, but not that. And it seems to me it behoves wise Christian Americans to learn how to get together, not only for the sake of Christian unity, but for the sake of your whole community.
Sir, we thank you for the call. There's one question I scheduled, but I have not yet put it to you, and time is so terribly short, but you may remember, as I introduced this program, reading from our description of what we were going to be doing, what the agenda was, I also raised the question about the decline, at least in terms of attendance, of Christianity in Europe.
I think that's probably bottomed out, actually. Certainly in the UK, I don't think it's getting that much worse because, okay, sometimes they say, well, the statistics are even worse here, but I could take you to churches which are new and opening and doing all sorts of lively things. Traditional forms of Christianity may be having a really rough time, and that's part cultural and all sorts of reasons for that. But there are new churches being built. There are people going to large congregations and having a wonderful time. And I'm simply speaking of the UK. I don't know that much about the rest of Europe. But, of course, the great news is that Christianity is flourishing in many other parts of the world.
That's why I mentioned Western Europe.
And they will be leading us, the Chinese church, the African church, etc.
And Anglicanism is very strong in Africa, is it?
Yeah, there are more Anglicans in church in Nigeria on a Sunday than in the whole of Britain and the U.S. put together.
Interesting. Does the Archbishop of Canterbury have to be a British citizen?
That question has never really been put. People, each time they're looking for a new archbishop, the question comes up, should we have him from elsewhere? Part of the difficulty is the Archbishop of Canterbury has to be the primus of the Church of England, so it's got to be somebody who is intimately familiar with the Church of England. Now, it's not impossible that somebody could come from the outside and do that.
Thanks so much for putting up with me for two long
Not at
hours.
All. Thank you for a great conversation. This has been fun.
I've enjoyed it tremendously. And Tom Wright's new book, Simply Jesus, A New Vision of Who He Was, What He Did, and Why He Matters, is just recently published by Harper One. In half a minute, a quick word about tomorrow night's program. We are taking on directly the economic dilemma that we all find ourselves in. We're not going to solve this at the national level, but rather in terms of personal finance. I've got three people joining me tomorrow night, all of whom are experts on financial management, and they will tell you what to do with your dwindling fortune, even as it continues to dwindle. And that's tomorrow at 10. One of our guests, in fact, is Terry Savage, who's well known as a major financial guru, who deserves her guruship, and two others join us as well. That's tomorrow at 10. And with that, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.